Thanks, everyone. All right. Yeah, he's still here. My name is Maren Harwood, grateful recovered alcoholic. Great to be here. Mother's Day. Happy Mother's Day. Interesting how Mother's Day. So I talked to my mom today, and she was just happy to speak with me and the kids and my wife, and we spoke for probably about 40 minutes on the phone, and it was not anything in depth, not anything crazy, it wasn't earth shattering, but not once I could not, because I remember talking to my mom when I was in active alcoholism, and it was a different tone with her. It was very, very much like walking on eggshells around me, because she didn't want to say the wrong thing, or because she still thought she was responsible for my drinking. Right? She still thought it was her fault then. And so I just the conversation today was so light. It was so nice. It was and we're going up to visit in July, so it's like we're excited about that. And she's asking about particulars and that, and there was nothing like she didn't have to ask if I was okay. You know what I mean? And I didn't have to convince her, quote unquote, that I was okay. It was a pretty, looking back on it, you know, during the conversation, it was just regular, normal conversation, right? And then looking back on it, and it's like my wife, you know, mother of our three kids, just a wonderful human being. Without her, I don't think I'm here today. You know, just not having to worry that I'm taking the car and going out. Not having to worry about how much is in the bank account. Not having to walk on eggshells anymore, and not, you know, saying the wrong thing around me anymore. It's a beautiful, freeing thing. Recovery from alcoholism is great for the alcoholic, right? But it's even better for the family around them. You know, so a lot of times they get left out of the story, and I think that when we chisel apart step 12, and we're going to do that. I'm here for this week, and then 2 weeks after that, we're going to do a lot of step 12 work, and we're going to focus heavily on how we can be the most, you know, as far as useful and helpful to the newcomer as humanly possible. That's really what the whole goal of this entire program is. How can we effectively carry the message that you don't have to feel this way anymore to the alcoholic? The best way to do that, obviously, is let them know that we felt that way before. We know what this is like. We have sat in that seat, literally, figuratively, however you want to put it. Right? I know what that feels like. You know, I know what it feels like to be a month in, right? And think I got everything under control, right? I know what it's like to be 6 months in, and now I know I have everything under control. And then I know what it's like to be years plus, and then all of a sudden realize, I got no control. I got nothing under control. Right? If I start thinking I got it under control, I need one of you people to like knock me back into place. Right? But I've got all this. Like, no, you really don't. Right? Because if I did, I wouldn't need to do this. Right? I wouldn't need to help the newcomer. Right? And we talked about it a couple of weeks ago. It's like these shortcomings, these defects of character, like, thank God I have them. Because without them, I wouldn't have to help the newcomer in here. Right. I wouldn't have that purpose or direction that God gave me to help the newcomer in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because if I wasn't still afraid, if I wasn't still angry, if I wasn't still resentful, you know, inconsiderate, dishonest, self-seeking, afraid, you name it. If I wasn't, you know, let's say all of those things, right? Then I wouldn't have to seek the guidance of and the peace that comes with helping another alcoholic. Right? So the question always has become, and one of my biggest things I've been, I guess you could call it hammering on or thumping on for years, is helping others. And one of the biggest questions I get is, how do I do it? You know, I don't want to say the wrong thing, or I don't want to do the wrong stuff, or I don't want to this or that. And I get that, but that's just overthinking Anonymous, right? It's like, I don't want to say the wrong thing. It's like, you're not going to say the wrong thing if your only aim, as we're going to read tonight, is to be helpful and useful. Like, that's it. If your motives are pure, you're going to have a pretty good shot at doing a good thing and doing right by the newcomer. So we're going to start on page 89, a little chapter called Working with Others. So again, if you don't really know how to work with others, it turns out they put an entire chapter about it, which is pretty good. So the first sentence in this chapter says everything you need to know about what the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is really all about. Practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. I feel like we missed this. Right? Ensuring immunity from drinking sounds pretty important. Right? I mean, for someone who couldn't put together more than a couple weeks for a number of years of quote unquote sobriety, right, then this is seemingly important, right? To the person coming in, it's like, wow, immunity from drinking, that sounds good, right? And it just doesn't say work with other alcoholics is intensive. Right? What does intensive mean? Right? It means way more than just the ordinary. Right? It means a more of like an extraordinary type of work. Right, with other alcoholics. It works when other activities fail. That's a funny little sentence to toss in there. What does that mean? Right. So what is he talking about? What other activities is he describing here? It's basically anything other than intensive work with other alcoholics. Prayer, meditation, right? Going to the gym, eating healthy, right? All those things, whatever, you fill in your blank. Whatever that is, other than intensive work with other alcoholics. So what is it telling me? It's like, it works when other activities fail. Not if. When other activities fail. This is our 12th suggestion. Carry the message to other alcoholics! Exclamation point. Let's not forget the punctuation in the book. It's very important. Right? He's everything short of begging you and telling you how important it is. Putting an exclamation point on carry this message. You can help when no one else can. That's a promise. He's promising you that you, right, the reader, right, can help the other alcoholic when no one else can. How hopeful is that? It almost adds an air of responsibility for somebody like me. It's like when I read something like that, it's like, oh my God, that means that people could be needlessly dying without my help. Right, it adds a level. It takes it to the next level. Page 89. We're just popping open the book. Right, so you could secure their confidence when others fail. Remember, they are very ill. This is a key concept through this chapter. It's going to remind us a few different times that remember the person that we're talking with is ill. And how do we know that? It's because we were past tense as well. Right? That's the whole key. The key to understanding this illness is to know that I was once like that as well. Right? If someone who suffers from migraine headaches tries to describe how it feels, the only people who are going to understand that are people who have migraine headaches as well. Right? I'm going to have a very difficult time explaining something that I've never felt or experienced before to anybody. I might be able to put some words together, and I might be able to maybe scientifically, because of a couple things that I've read about it. Doctors are wonderful human beings, and they try to help people like us, and they've gone to school for a long time. But man, can they not understand or describe what it's like to feel, right, like an alcoholic? Like, they don't know that. Right. They might know the dopamine serotonin response. They might know what it, you know, physically what it might do to us. They might know how our metabolism's a little bit different, and they might be able to draw it back to some sort of hereditary thing, and they can draw some conclusions from all that, and you know, but they don't understand what it's like to be the loneliest person in a room full of people. Right? They don't understand what it's like to look in the eyes of a loved one who's just trying to love us sober and then not be able to do it. Looking in someone in the eyes that we love to death and telling them that we're done forever. Meaning it from the bottom of our heart. And then 2 hours later going to get what we need to get. Right? The people who have not experienced that do not know what that is like. Therefore, that's what gives us the ultimate weapon to forge against the disease of addiction. Having experienced it before. Right? So, looking at it from an entirely different angle, someone who's on the other side of this whole thing might say, well, it turns out, right, being an alcoholic is the best thing that ever happened to me. If you think about it that way, without that experience, I'm unable to affect and change the world in this way. Maybe, just maybe, there's a specific reason why somebody like me survived active alcoholism and addiction. Is to be able to carry a message to people who are still suffering from it. Maybe there's part of our purpose is involved in that. I don't know. I don't know the plan. I'm not privy to the plan, and if I did, I'd be God. But it turns out that when it comes to freedom and feeling lack of the bondage of self that the book describes, and all of these this kind of locked within me, and this restless, irritable, discontented, sober mindset that I felt, nothing's freed me more from that than sitting down one-on-one with another alcoholic. Nothing. Nothing. Here's some 12-step promises. This is, again, provided that we, are in a good nature and a good, well-meaning, right, to other people. Life will take on new meaning. Interesting, the word new, right? Even just that little word that's kind of tossed in here a little bit. Like, let's consider what that word means. Never before experienced. That's what the word new means. Right. So if we're still feeling right, if life is taking on still the same old meaning, we might be missing something. Right. So new, never before experienced meaning, to watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow up about you, to have a host of friends. This is an experience you must not miss. We know you will not want to miss it. Frequent contact with newcomers and with each other is the bright spot of our lives, right? Pretty important to bring into context here how frequent they had AA meetings when this book was written. They didn't really have them, right? They did in the area where this was written. They had a couple here or there, Akron and Cleveland. There was a small faction, obviously, in New York where Bill was, just a small bit, right? But when they sat down and talked about this thing, and everyone was together, and what would happen is these folks would bring in newcomers into the fellowship. I also want to point out that fellowship is lowercase in this sense. They make it a capitalized one a little bit later in the next few pages. So it means there's two different fellowships, right? The lowercase fellowship is of the human kind, and the uppercase fellowship with a capitalized F in fellowship is meaning that it's aimed at God, right? So this fellowship that we're talking about here, to see the fellowship grow about you, would mean the people around you, right, with the same common theme, common thread, right? And to have a host of friends, again, an experience you must not miss, frequent contact with newcomers and with each other is the bright spot of our lives today. Again, there's a level of frequency involved here. Right. So again, frequent, often, it's not saying an exact time frame, right? But they used to get together once a week. When AA kind of first started, obviously, you can almost accidentally walk into an AA meeting these days, so that we can have as much contact with newcomers and with us as much as you would like, right? Or as much as you think you need these days. It was a little different then when this was written. Perhaps you are not acquainted with any drinkers who want to recover. Again, context. This book used to be the message when it was sent out to the alcoholic who was suffering, and they were reading through this book and doing what it says. They might be living, and I use this example every time, on a farm out in Kansas, right? They might not know other alcoholics. They might not get out all that much, right? But it's going to tell them, right, those folks, kind of how to get acquainted with them, how to find them. You can easily find someone by asking a few doctors, ministers, priests, or hospitals. They will be only too glad to assist you. Don't start out as an evangelist or reformer. Why did they put that in there? Because that's the way Bill started. He'd run around and grab people off bar stools, tell them you need to find God. Right? He was not very successful for the first 6 months or so. Right, until the proverbial, hit the fan at the Mayflower Hotel. And we all know that story, right? But the idea is, that's probably more than likely why that's plugged in, because it's not effective, right? It's not an effective approach. Unfortunately, a lot of prejudice exists. You'll be handicapped if you arouse it. Ministers and doctors are competent and can learn much, and you can learn much from them if you wish. But it happens that because of your own drinking experience, you can be uniquely useful to other alcoholics. So cooperate, never criticize. To be helpful is our only aim. Therefore, right? And when I look at a sentence like this, I take it a couple different ways. First thing is, okay, to be helpful is our only aim, which would imply that if you have other aims, that's not what the way the book is describing, right? Is my aim to be helpful? There's a pretty good prayer, right? God, help my aim to be helpful today. Like, that's not all that bad, right? If that's, that should be, right? It's telling that that's what their only aim is, the writers of the book, right? Let's look at the verbiage, right? So cooperate, never criticize. He's telling that to the reader. And then he's telling the reader to be helpful is our, meaning the people who wrote the book, it's their only aim, right? So that would imply that maybe the reader, that might not be their only aim at this point. But let's kind of move towards that direction, is my assumption, right? It doesn't say that, but the way they use the verbiage in the book, right? It's not saying to be helpful is your only aim. It's saying it's our only aim, meaning that's where, that's what we've gotten to. This is where we're at. This is how we stay well, right? Maybe you should aim towards this with us, right? So let's keep that in mind as we're reading this. It's going to take different contexts. Page 90, very top. When you discover a prospect for Alcoholics Anonymous, find out all you can about him. If he does not want to stop drinking, don't waste time trying to persuade him. Interesting sentence there, right? Couple little keys here, right? So here's one of my favorite things to ask, right? How do you know if someone wants to stop drinking? Ask them. Ask them. Well, he's in AA. He must want to stop. Like, I don't know. There's court-ordered sheets. Like, do you need him to stay in the sober house? Sometimes you need him because you went to court and you got to get something signed that's there. And maybe you're just trying to get the heat off a little bit, right? Just trying to get a couple more bucks in the bank account. Just trying to get use of the car again. Just trying to get a job. Just trying to whatever. Like, I'm just trying to get the heat off a little bit. Like, I don't really want to stop drinking, right? I just need to go to your little get-togethers and get my sheet signed so, you know, my wife will trust me again. Or I'll get my job back. Or the EAP from my work is going to allow me to go back into my job, like whatever it might be. Like, that's, again, we can ask that question. It's not a terrible question to ask the newcomer, really. I mean, it's like, well, that's a little upfront. Like, I don't think it is. I mean, really, if you find out all you can about him, right, if he does not want to stop, don't waste time trying to persuade him. Well, I really don't want to stop. Or a lot of times, and what we'll get today is, well, I'm just doing other substances. At least I'm not drinking, right? There's that sort of stuff kind of gets into play today, right? And so we can kind of toe the line, and there's different factions and opinions about all that. And I'm not trying to jump into all this, but at the same time, I don't know about your experience with this, but I can tell you mine. My narcotic bone is connected to my drink bone, and vice versa. Right. So if we're, you know, again, I'm not a toe the line type. Right. If you want to stop and cease forever, because that's what our book promises us, there's a way to do that. And it's going to tell us exactly how to approach that with the newcomer and what we can do to offer this to them. Right. But it says, if he doesn't want to stop, don't waste time trying to persuade him. You may spoil a later opportunity. What does that imply? That implies that they might come back again. So what are we supposed to do? Plant the seed, right? And that's what my sponsor told me after I got off the phone with him sobbing that someone had overdosed, and I was distraught by it. Someone I was trying to help, and he literally said, like, you're not God, right? You can't make them get it. You can't make them understand it. You can't make them anything, right? And it's really, let's just plant the seed. And if the pain gets bad enough and they survive it, they'll be back. So let's not spoil an opportunity by just pounding them and saying, gotta do this, gotta do this, gotta do this, gotta do this. And they might not come back. Right? Even if they have an opportunity to come back, they might not. Right? So the idea is, let's plant the seed. Find out all we can about them and ask them if they're interested in stopping. And if they're interested in stopping forever, right? Because that's what the book talks about. The book talks about permanent recovery. Right? It talks about that. It also talks about, well, one day at a time, but we learn how to live life one day at a time. That's what the book says, right? It doesn't say anything about staying sober one day at a time. What it says, we learn how to live life one day at a time, and a side effect of that is staying sober forever. Right? That's the whole point. So this advice is given for his family also. They should be patient, realizing they are dealing with a sick person. Obviously easier said than done. My family wanted me sober yesterday, right, when I was in active addiction. They wanted, you know, just again, the peace of mind of knowing that they weren't going to get a phone call saying that I was, you know, dead in a ditch somewhere or whatever. Like, there's that. But again, we can also offer this to the family. Let's not forget that point. Right? Sometimes we go to meetings and someone's new to AA and they bring a supportive family member with them. Probably because they don't trust them to leave on their own, one. Or two is because maybe they just want to know what this whole thing is about. What do they talk about in these classes, right? What are they going? What are we going over here? What are we discussing, right? And we could also offer this to the family, is what it's saying, right? We can offer them, peace of mind and let them know that this person, they're dealing with a sick person. Not just someone who chooses to hurt people around them or themselves, right? It's beyond the power of choice at this point if someone's in active addiction or alcoholism, right? So we got to let them know. We can probably educate them a little bit on the disease or the malady, right, of what addiction really is and what alcoholism really is. If there's any indication he wants to stop, have a good talk with the person most interested in him, usually his wife. Get an idea of his behavior, his problems, his background, the seriousness of his condition, and his religious leanings. You need this information to put yourself in his place, to see how you would like him to approach you if the tables were turned. Now, also, keep in mind, who's doing the approaching, right? The person who has gotten well is supposed to be approaching the newcomer. Not the other way around. The treatment center industry has done a good job of kind of straightening us up, meaning getting us detoxed and getting us introduced to AA, but they've plugged in some ideas that are the opposite of our book, right? The book tells us that we're supposed to be going out. It's going to tell us, as we read on over and over again, that we're to make the approach to the newcomer. We're supposed to let them know, right, that we have a solution, that we have something to offer, right, that we can help. If you're interested in a program of recovery, let me outline that for you. And again, I'm skipping ahead a little bit, but that's exactly what it tells us to do, is to outline the program of action. Let them know exactly what we felt like, exactly what we did, and exactly how we are now. Like, that's it. That's really what it's asking us to describe to them. Let's see, if you need this information, put yourself in a place to see where you can be approached at the table's return. Sometimes it is wise to wait until he goes on a binge. The family may object to this, but unless he is in dangerous physical condition, it is better to risk it. Don't deal with him when he is very drunk unless he is ugly and the family needs your help. Wait for the end of a spree or at least for a lucid interval. Then let his family or friend ask him if he wants to quit for good and if he would go to any extreme to do so. If he says yes, then his attention should be drawn to you as a person who has recovered. That's exactly the point when I speak in Alcoholics Anonymous, and whenever they allow me to, I do so, and I refer to myself as a recovered alcoholic. It even says it in the reading in here by alcoholics who have recovered. And they say, well, you can't really say that. It's like, well, I just did. And two, that's where it tells me I refer to myself as a recovered alcoholic in the big book. Page 90, paragraph 3. Right? It should be a person, should be drawn to you, a person who has recovered. Meaning, the way I'm approaching the family is, I've recovered from this. The way I'm approaching the world is, I've recovered from this, right? So that's literally when the book tells us at this point, as we're helping other people, let them know we've recovered. You should be described to him as one of a fellowship, again, lowercase, who as part of their own recovery try to help others, and who will be glad to talk with him if he cares to see you. If he does not want to see you, never force yourself upon him. Neither should the family hysterically plead with him to do anything, nor should they tell him much about you. They should wait for the end of his next drinking bout. You might place this book where he can see it in the interval. Here, no specific rule is given. The family must decide these things, but urge them not to be over anxious, for that might spoil matters. Usually the family should not try to tell your story. When possible, avoid meeting a man through his family. Approach, again, it's telling us, right, that we should do the approaching. Approach through a doctor or an institution is your better bet. If your man needs hospitalization, he should have it, but not forcibly unless he is violent. Let the doctor, if he will, tell him he has something in the way of a solution. See, this is jam-packed with read-between-the-lines information. So if we're approaching people at institutions, which normally means we have to approach through the doctors right, or the clinical people at these institutions, whether it's a rehab, detox, IOP, whatever it is. Like, if we're gonna find a best way to help people who are early on in their recovery, those are the spots to do it. Therefore, if we're able to discuss this with a doctor, therapist, psychologist, or somebody who's willing to listen, and we let them know, hey, we've got a solution for this. If you have someone, I'm not trying to take them off of, your docket or anything like that. I'm just trying to be helpful, just trying to be useful. And if they'd like to have a conversation with me, I'd be more than happy to help them out, right? If we can plant the seed, not only with the alcoholic, but with the people who are in these institutions, they might say, oh, hey, well, this person just stopped by the other day. Okay, you've got a drinking problem. Maybe I should connect you to, right? Because they want to help, right? They ultimately want to help. When your man is better, the doctor might suggest a visit from you. Though you have talked with the family, leave them out of the first discussion. Under these conditions, your prospect will see he is under no pressure. He will feel that he can deal with you without being nagged by his family. Call on him while he is still jittery. He may be more receptive when depressed. Interesting concept here. Right. So again, this is in the hospital setting. Right. We've got someone who has gone to the hospital, detoxed, whatever the case might be, still maybe shaking a little bit, still very, very, very early recovery under doctor's watch. The doctor has met with you. You tell, hey, I might be able to help someone who's in this scenario or in this situation. And they say, all right, come on in. I've got somebody. You can meet with them tomorrow. And you do so when you sit down with them and you don't bring up the family, don't bring up anything. Basically, but it's very early on, you may be more receptive when depressed, right? And Bill's not a doctor. He's not talking about clinical depression, which is still, at this time, when this book was written and printed in 1939, in its infancy, they didn't really know a ton about the different levels in the brain and about clinical depression and the difference between just feeling low or blue and an actual clinical mental state of depression. So using the word depressed here is not someone, again, we're talking clinically depressed, so I'm not going to go medicating people and I have no clout to do anything along those lines. But the point would be, what he's talking about is when they're kind of more in the very infant stages of recovery, still kind of down in the dumps a little bit, when they're still in the hospital, a little bit jittery. Like, that's the best time. They might be more receptive. Why? Because they haven't gotten a few meals in them yet, right? Because they're not comfortable yet. That's the big thing. If I'll tell you right now, some of these rehabs I've been to, because I worked in the industry for a little bit, like a cup of coffee, really, like 6 months. But some of these treatment centers are like real retreats. Like, talk about comfortable, like Tempur-Pedic beds, big screen TVs, like it's almost luxurious. There's a few places that I could just list off the top of my head that are just like, they're incredible. That you are comfortable. Let's just say that. Right? They'll bring meals to you until you can get up out of bed, right? And they'll, like, it's wild. And then there's the other side of things. Usually the more state-run facilities look a little bit different, right? But and they're not bringing anything to you except for an attitude most of the time. But the point is, it doesn't necessarily matter. The idea is, how do we get someone who's most receptive is when they're probably the most uncomfortable. Meaning, just not winning yet. Let's call it that, or whatever their idea of winning is, right? Sometimes winning in early recovery is just like getting up out of bed on your own, right? That's But my point would be, if they've been in a comfortable treatment setting or wherever for 30, 60, 90 days, a lot of times the longer that time goes, the less receptive they're going to be. Window of opportunity is not very big, and not only that, it closes rapidly, right? And I'm just telling you that from my experience, right? And not only helping others, or at least attempting to help others, but in my personal experience, right? If you give me just like 3 or 4 days recovering on mom's couch when I'm like in my 20s, like I'm gonna snap back. I'm gonna be just fine. After a few days, I'm gonna be okay, right? But the point is, that window of opportunity is now closed. All of a sudden, now I don't really need to go back to AA or anything like that. I just need to get my job back, or just, just, yeah, just, you know what? I'll get, I'll just, I'll just go back to work, and you know what? I'm gonna have a talk with my ex-girlfriend. I'm gonna patch things up there, and you know, I'm trying to put things together. And then my family's thinking, oh, you know what? Man, Marin's doing good. He's got his job back. He's coming home at a reasonable time, and you know, he's giving me his money now. He's giving me his money. I'm gonna be his bank. So okay, all right, Mom and Dad, you're the recovery center and the bank. Right? How's that work? You know, and then all of a sudden, I can't believe he drank again. I can't believe it. Oh my God, what happened? Right? You know what happened was there was no sufficient change in mindset while sober. Right? That's the whole thing. Right? The sober mind says alcohol is a good idea. That's the sober mind that needs to be changed. Once that mind is changed, then how do we maintain something like that? It just told me. Immunity from drinking is intensive work with other alcoholics. So there's sufficient change in mindset. Good. Excellent. Rock on. Maybe, right? We're doing a little prayer. Maybe we're inventorying. Maybe we're doing that on a daily basis. Maybe we're making some amends to people in the past. Maybe, I don't know, and then everything's going well, and then all of a sudden the time comes, maybe we should work with another alcoholic. Oh no, I'm not ready. My home group told me I need to wait a year to help people, right? But it's a good thing no one told Ebbie Thatcher that. Right. Ebbie Thatcher was 2 months sober when he approached Bill Wilson at his house. Right. Ebbie Thatcher went there while Bill Wilson was drinking gin at his kitchen table. Actually, in all actuality, Bill would drink gin and juice. So he's sipping on gin and juice, right? Laid back. That's what Bill would, and that, so he would drink it with pineapple juice, by the way. I don't know, it's a deep cut AA. But anyway, so he approached Bill with 2 months sober while Bill was drinking. So here's some advice they did not give Ebbie Thatcher. They did not tell Ebbie to wait a year to help people. They did not tell Ebbie to stay away from people, places, and things. If that was the case, I might not be here today. The point was, Ebbie Thatcher had a sufficient change in mind, a sufficient change in mindset, a spiritual awakening as a result of the 6 tenets of the Oxford Group. That was enough for him to be able to say, hey, Ebbie, who's an alcoholic that you know that could use this solution? Right? That's the caveat. Am I saying that, hey, you're sober 2 months, like go run and hang out with your buddies at the bar? No. That's not what I'm saying. Or just go hang out and chill and whatever like that. No. What I'm saying is there's a caveat to all this. Right? We've got to have a spiritual awakening, right, as a result of the steps, call it whatever you want, a sufficient change in mindset, a perception change is what the book calls it too. Call it whatever you like. But the same mind that went into the first meeting of AA or the first treatment center or whatever, it can't be the same mind as that. That's the case. If it's not the same, then great. But what will happen is a lot of people will say, I can't go help people. I'm not ready. Right? If we're doing that, we're playing God again. Doesn't matter if you are ready. Is the newcomer ready? And it seems like they probably are. Because they're in our meetings of AA. They're all over the place. We can't stay away from them. Here they come. Oh, I'm not ready to help them yet. Someone else will do it. It's like, I don't know, man. God seemed to put you guys in the same room at the same time for a very specific reason. My assumption is maybe you can carry a message to them that maybe nobody else can. And how would you know if you don't try? Right? How would you know? At least plant the seed. You wouldn't know. It's playing God. It's the idea is like, well, I know that I can't carry a message to them, so I'll let somebody else do it. It's like, what a cop-out. I'm sorry. But it's just the case. Even if it's just as hopeful as, hey, it's great seeing you. I'm glad you're here. If you're interested in a solution, we're here to help. Done. Even if it's just that. Right? Again, not being the evangelist or the reformer, not telling him they've got to find God or they've got to this or got to that. Like, we'll chop away at all that a little later in this chapter too. It tells them. It's like, we got to tell them it's their own conception. Don't believe mine because, you know, mine's just mine and that's it. Like, but the point would be, if we have an opportunity and we don't take it, we're being selfish. I don't care if it's 1 day sober, 2 days sober, 2 weeks sober, 2 years sober, 10 years, 20 years sober. If we have an opportunity to help someone in the room and we don't do it, we're being selfish. There's no other way to put it. It's me getting in the way of me again. It's me giving an excuse why I can't again. And I've done that over and over my whole life, and it was not fruitful until I did that enough to wind up in an institution And then that institution where I came out and my sponsor told me, this is where, right, this is where you get well. In AA, helping a newcomer. When it's inconvenient, when it's 2 a.m, when you got to drive them to this place, and they just think all they need is a pack of Newports. I just need a pack of smokes and I'm going to be okay. It's like, all right, little buddy, get in the car with me. Let's talk about the first 3 steps on the way. Right? And maybe they're going to get it. Maybe they won't. Maybe they'll understand a couple things. And then when they come back around, maybe after that they'll start dodging you because they don't want to hear the truth. And then all of a sudden, there's going to be a time when the pain gets bad enough and they remembered that that corny guy walking around with the blue book who talks about hope and talks about God and talks about how he's got some things back and talks about how his life he says the word freedom all the time, and it's just, maybe I should have a chat with him. Right? And then there we are. Because why? Because there's this fellowship that's created about us. And frequent contact with newcomers, right, and us is the bright spot of our lives. So why would we not go back? It's the bright spot. This is where it happens, right? This is where the light comes in. This is where we get an opportunity, right, to learn how to live out there for the next 23 hours. Right? That's the whole point. That's why we come to this. And then a newcomer comes in and it's like, okay, cool, like this is great. Let's discuss the hope. Let's discuss how we got there. Let's put this together for them. And if they're interested, rock on. Let's go. And if they're not, that's okay too, because guess what? We're still going to be here. Right? Right? That's also hopeful. You might also see that as like, well, all right, but it's not pompous and it's not cocky. It's like, man, God is so good. He's got my back. God is so good. When I get in the way, God reminds me I'm in the way over and over and over again. And it's the same thing when a newcomer comes in. I'll be like, oh, you know what? Joe's going to help him. I'm good. I got some things to do. And it's like, man, there you are again, showing up, playing God. Right? So let's see. So now, where were we? If he does not want to see you, never force yourself. Then we went to the next. Usually the family should not try to tell your story. We did that too. When your man is better, he might suggest a visit from you. More receptive when depressed. See your man alone if possible. At first, engage in general conversation. After a while, turn the talk to some phase of drinking. Tell him enough of your drinking habits, symptoms, and experience to encourage him to speak for himself. If he wishes to talk, let him do so. You will thus get a better idea of how you ought to proceed. If he is not communicative, give him a stretch of your drinking career up to the time you quit, but say nothing for the moment of how it was accomplished. If he's in a serious mood, dwell on the troubles liquor has caused you, being careful not to moralize or lecture. If the mood is light, tell him humorous stories of your escapades. Get him to tell some of his. This is exactly how we break the ice with the newcomer. Doesn't say we're talking about the steps. Doesn't say we're talking about God. It's literally about our experiences. Right? And depending upon what mood they are in, we can kind of come at it from whatever angle that is asking, again, however that is. And again, the idea would be we have to be able to sit down with somebody and kind of read a little bit into where they're at. Body language is a part of that. I mean, there's some general psychological stuff, but it's just in general as a vibe. I'm pretty good at telling if someone is like open to talking or if they're not. I don't know. And some people might not be, but you don't have to be an expert at it. But the point would be, what is it telling us? Don't tell them about the recovery piece yet. Tell them about our experiences, right? And then if they're in a laughing mood or if they're a little open, right? Tell them some of the escapades, as it says, right? Humorous stories, right? And then get them to tell some of his. After we've broken the ice a little bit, when he sees you know all about the drinking game, commence, which means to begin, to describe yourself as an alcoholic. Tell him how baffled you were, how you finally learned that you were sick. Give him an account of the struggles you made to stop. Show him the mental twist which leads to the first drink of a spree. That is key. Mental twist. He's going to call it in the next paragraph a queer blank spot, right? So it's like the mental twist. Meaning, right, more than anything else, your brain told you it was a good idea to drink again. Right? That's in spite of everything else, in spite of all of the evidence that says that that's probably not a good idea. Right? That's what he's talking about. Right? The first drink. Right? That's the, as he calls it, the insanity of the first drink as well. First drink of a spree. The mental twist. We suggest you do this as we have done in the chapter on alcoholism. There's a good suggestion, right? So it's like, now go back to the chapter more about alcoholism. It's saying refer back to that. Go back to that area of the book. Read that with them. Right? Maybe they'll mention some things. Or again, the idea of that chapter, and it talks about it over and over again, is the crux of the problem, the hinge point. Right? That's the issue, is the mental twist. If he is alcoholic, he will understand you at once. He will match your mental inconsistencies with some of his own. If you are satisfied that he is a real alcoholic, begin to dwell on the hopeless feature of the malady. So here's where we're at, right? We're kind of discussing with him the issues, the problems, maybe a little, you know, we're laughing about it a little bit, right? And then we start discussing, right, how sick I was and you know, how unable to stop on my own and the mental blank spot, the twist, right? And then boom, hopeless feature of the malady. Right. It's literally, we're climbing and then boom, we hit him with the hopeless feature of it. Malady means illness, right? Show him from your own experience how the queer mental condition surrounding the first drink prevents normal functioning of the willpower in spite of everything I know and everything that all the evidence, right? All of the evidence is put in front of me. That's why the age-old advice, which is not great advice for the newcomer, is to play the tape all the way through. You ever hear anyone? You ever say, like, play the tape all the way through. Remember your last drunk. It's like, it doesn't work for real alcoholics, unfortunately. Right? It might put a little pause instead, right? It might pause it for a second, but unfortunately that's not sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism, or else we wouldn't need to do the steps. You just remember the last drunk and the humiliation it talks about on page 24. Like, we can't remember the suffering or humiliation of even a week or a month ago or without defense against the first drink. Right? So it's telling us here, right, that the normal function of the willpower is not there. Don't at this stage refer to this book unless he has seen it and wishes to discuss it. And be careful not to brand him as an alcoholic. Let him draw his own conclusion. So it's telling us two different things, and this is what we've got to point out, right? In the top of the paragraph it says, if you're satisfied, he's a real alcoholic, right? So meaning, and on page 44 where it asks the qualifying questions, right? Or they're not really built as questions in the book, but they're built as the paragraph format. The reader's supposed to be asking themselves. In the beginning of We Agnostics, it tells us, hey, anytime you tried to stop drinking on your own, could you? And anytime you put one in your system, do you know how many you were going to take? Right? If you could be suffering from an illness, which only a spiritual experience will conquer. Right? That's what it talks about in the top of 44. So how do we know we're a real alcoholic? That's where you go. How do we know that they are a real alcoholic? We could ask them those questions. You ever started drinking? Right? And with the intention on stopping and not be able to do so. Yeah. Have you ever tried to stop on your own entirely forever and been unable to do that? Yeah. Yeah, I have. So you can draw your conclusion right there. If you're satisfied he's a real alcoholic, there. It's not your job to say, okay, you're alcoholic. Like, that's the difference between these two. Hey, I've drawn a couple conclusions from what you're telling me. Let's discuss this a little bit further. And then boom, boom, boom. And then let him draw his own conclusion. If he sticks to the idea that he can still control his drinking, tell him that he possibly can if he's not too alcoholic. But insist that if he is severely afflicted, there may be little chance he can recover by himself. Hey, I can control my drinking. I'll just drink beer on the weekends. Be like, all right, little Timmy, you might be able to do that. You might be able to. However, from what you've told me, you sound very similar to my story. You sound very similar to what I went through, as far as feelings wise and all that. And you might be able to do that. I was unable to. Right? I needed a little something more. And it sounds like, since this is your 14th, you're coming out of your 14th treatment center, right? And you're at your, you know, 1,000th AA meeting, and you've got the benefit of step zero, right? You might need a little something different, right? Again, we're not trying to convince them and say, you have to do this. It's more of like, let's just kind of look at where things are and what got us to this point and let them draw the conclusion, right? But again, if he's severely afflicted, right? If he's similar to the way you were when you first came in, if we're hammering home that point, they might say, you know what? You're right. Continue to speak of alcoholism as an illness, a fatal malady. Whew. Right? Don't, we're not, again, it's not sugarcoating this thing. Like, oh, well, if you want it bad enough, we'll love you till you love yourself. Have a seat here. Like, that's not what he's talking about. That's not what this says. Continue to speak of alcoholism as an illness, a fatal malady. This is going to kill you if you keep doing what you're doing. Right? If you're as bad as I was, and it sounds maybe like you might be, then you're on the track to dying from this. This is a progressive, fatal illness. It never gets better if left untreated. It's like an open wound. We either solder that thing or we sew it shut, we throw some antibiotic cream on it, and like that's that. There's some early treatment right there. Right, that's the triage we talked about last week or the week before. Like, we get to perform triage with the newcomer, right? But if they're going to sit there with the open wound and be like, well, I think I'll be all right this time. I mean, it doesn't look that bad. It's not as bad as it was before, or it could be way worse, or I'm not as bad as they are, or whatever. I mean, that's, we hear that all the time. They don't necessarily have to say that, but when they come in, look around the room and say, well, I'm different from them. Remember last week we talked about the difference between alcohol and alcoholism are three letters, ISM, right? One is what I suffer from is the internal spiritual malady, right? But when I first come into AA and the newcomers were going to help, the different ISM is I separate myself. So when they come in, right, when I came in, I separated myself from everybody. I'm not old enough to be here. My first AA meeting, I was 19 years old. I thought they were going to kick me out because I was too young, right? Little did I know it was very different than that, but I came in, right, and I'm thinking, okay, they're gonna kick me out because I'm too young. And then when I'm leaving that meeting, I had one thought and one thought only. I need a drink. Right? And it's not because of anything that they said at that meeting, right? It's because what did they do? They tapped into something emotionally in me that I felt I actually belonged there, right? And I didn't like that feeling. So I wanted that feeling to go away. Again, it was restless, irritable, discontented that I felt, right? And they weren't going to stop me no matter how long they made that meeting go, no matter how many step ones they were talking about in that meeting. It didn't even matter. It was called the meeting was called the KISS meeting, keep it simple, stupid, right? And it was on all the books, said the word KISS on all. I'll never forget. It was like upstairs in a church, not in a basement. It was like upstairs in a church. And I remember climbing up those steps and I walk in the room and everyone turns their head. It's like an old creaky turn. Like, right? And then I'm standing there and then and they're like, oh, come on in. And you know, he says, your first time here? And I'm like, yeah, my first time like ever. Never been to an AA meeting. And they like, okay, we're talking about step one. Here, sit here. And then I couldn't remember anything other than that. Other than the entire time, I was just like, I feel like I belong. This feels right. Get me the hell out of here. Right? Because I knew there was some things that came along with all that. And one was not drinking anymore. Right? And so that was a big piece. They talked about that a lot. Right? And I was not about that. Right? I figured I could do it on my own, or I wish I could kind of jump back into that mindset just to see like where it was. But I can't even really remember what was going through my brain. All I know is that I needed relief. And the only relief I could ever find up to that point was alcohol. That was the only thing that gave me some sort of solace. It was the only thing that gave me, as a doctor's opinion calls it, that sense of ease and comfort. Right? That was it. They were talking about other things. They were, and what we talk about in here. They were talking about prayer, meditation, God, helping others, you know, being able to spend time with their family, being able, you know, it's like all the stuff. Like I didn't have that. I had one out. And it was alcohol, right? So There's a feature of the malady. Again, we're talking about how it can kill you, right? Show it from your own experience. There we are. Conditions. Talk about the conditions of the body and mind which accompany it. This is like the doctor's opinion, right? Physical allergy, mental obsession, right? We can always draw back from there onto that chapter. It's still there in black and white. We can go sit back and read it, right? Again, the body is just as sick as the mind, and that's the way the doctor's opinion talks about it. The allergy is an abnormal reaction to a substance, right? When I put alcohol in my system, I react differently than the general population. Alcohol is a central nervous system depressant. I don't feel tired when I drink alcohol. I feel something way different than that. Tons of energy, ready to go. Let's go to Atlantic City, and I'll quit my job. Right? That's poof, right there, instantly. Right? I'll figure it out later. Let's keep doing this. Right? That's where I'm at. Right? So my reaction is very different. On Mother's Day, as I always talk about this, if you were to ask my mom, and I've asked her this, how does it feel when you drink alcohol? She's like, oh, I don't know. She doesn't like it. Like, it doesn't compute to her as something that could be any sort of therapeutic at all. She's just like, it doesn't taste that good. It makes me feel out of control. Like, it makes my stomach hurt. Like, it just makes me tired. Like, she just doesn't like it. It literally just doesn't like it. It's like, I couldn't care what it tasted like. What is it going to do for me? Alcohol did something for me, right, that it doesn't do for the general population. That's what makes me alcoholic. Not what it does to me, but what it does for me. So that's what makes us different. So if we can describe that to the newcomer, right, that's what it's literally... Take that experience, right? And it says we don't regret the past, nor do we wish to shut the door on it, right? In the Ninth Step Promises. Why is it telling me that? Because I have to draw back on that to help the newcomer. I can't shut the door on the past because then that it's closing an opportunity for the newcomer to know that I have the same experience they have when they're coming in, right? And I can't relate to the newcomer if I don't talk about the past stuff, the ugly stuff. If I don't open that door up and draw from that, I'm not going to be able to help the newcomer because they're not going to be able to relate. All I say is, well, you just do the steps and you'll get better. It's like, that's not a good approach. Pretty good approach is, I felt that way, I know what that's like, let me tell you about that, and then let me tell you about how a little program of action, right, that someone kind of shoved me into, right, got me better, right? That's the whole point of all this. So we're almost there, let me see. Explain that many are doomed who never realize their predicament. We're going to start back on this next week. This is a heavy hitter paragraph. Because it's talking about fatal. It's talking about, right, they're doomed. They don't realize their predicament. Like, this is the type of language that they were talking about with new people back when the book was written. Right? And that language was, this could kill you. And if left untreated, probably will. If you understand and realize your predicament, that's good. But if you stay this way, you're doomed to die, as the book calls it, an alcoholic death. Right. So, again, it seems like we're hitting in certain spots with these folks, and we are with the newcomer. We kind of have to, in order for them to hear us. Right. The idea of, well, the door is always going to be open. That's true. Right. But how many people? And I don't know for sure this number. If I did it, I don't know. It probably hurt me more than it helps. But how many people sat in a room of Alcoholics Anonymous? Right. And a 12-step room, let's just call it a 12-step room, and then left, and then went back out and used or drank again, and never made it back in. Right? Only because they thought, well, I could always go back to AA. Right? I can always go back there. I could always make it back in. And that's a good thing. That tells us that our fellowship is a place, a warm place for them to go. Right? Maybe literally and figuratively, like it's a place for them to show up. That's good. We've created a good atmosphere there. But what about the idea that if they leave without at least dropping some solution in them, that they might not make it back? Right? And who knows? I say this all the time. If I could have borrowed another $20, I don't think I'd be here today. Right? So I was at that spot. So if they're at that spot and they walk in here and they do have a place where they can quote unquote borrow that other $20. Right, we might never see them again. So as an obligation or responsibility personally for me is that let's make sure that they understand what they're really up against, when they come into our meetings, that they're not up against alcohol. Alcohol is just a liquid. It says, remember, we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, and powerful. Not remember alcohol is cunning, baffling, powerful. That we deal with alcohol mentally. How we deal with it is cunning, baffling, and powerful. Not the liquid itself. Right? The mental states, it just told me twice in here, that I have a mental twist when it comes to alcohol, which is just a liquid. It's not going to grow legs and run and jump into my face. Like, it's not powerful like that. Right? It might seem like that, but my brain says, I've got to pick it up. My brain says, I've got to put it into my system. The mental blank spot or the twisted thinking says so. Right? That's what's powerful. The way I deal with it. Remember, we deal with alcohol. Cunning, baffling, powerful. So that's the point. If we can hammer that home to the newcomer, and that's what it's telling us to do. Tell us about the physical, the mental aspects of the first drink. And if we can describe that to them and they can understand, then next week when we start going over this a little bit further, it's going to tell us how to approach that person who is ready, willing, and open, right, for us to approach them with this spiritual program of action. All right? Thanks, guys. I really appreciate you being here. Thank you.